Well, welcome back, folks. It's the monthly edition of the Energy Report here on KVMR-FM. My name is Martin Webb. Big thanks to Michael Benn and Skip Allen Smith, as always. And a huge thanks to everyone that pledged their support during this most recent pledge drive. That's what keeps us afloat. That's right. Thanks to the business underwriters, as always. But thanks for every show and every program goes out to the listeners that support through their membership. And for the upcoming hour of programming, thanks in part goes out to Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service using sunshine, wind, and water to meet local power needs. Their specialties include on-site consultations, financial cost-benefit analysis, and guidance from education to installation. www.planitsolar.com, 530-432-3776. We'll be back in just a moment. We've got some live on-air guests. We're going to talk solar here on the Energy Report. It's my pleasure, as always, to be here the first Thursday of every month on KVMR hosting the Energy Report. And one of the main reasons that I started doing this show, it was almost exactly 4 years ago, of course, that we had the last presidential election. And I was keenly interested in the proceedings, listening to all the debates, and I was really disappointed at how little of a focus the topic of energy was given 4 years ago. And at the time, it was actually not that easy to find news about energy. Oftentimes, it was in the business pages of the newspaper or it was in obscure magazines. And so I started this monthly show as a way to sort of aggregate all of that info and make it easier for you to get. And my, how times have changed. 4 years later, suddenly, energy is a huge topic during the election and in politics in general. And folks have now made the connection between energy and the environment and geopolitics and economies and jobs and that type of thing. And so I'm really excited that things have changed so much in 4 years. But one thing that I have been a little disappointed about is now the media is hungry for any info about renewable energy and about solar and wind, hydro, you name it, alternative biofuels. And as someone that is involved in the renewable energy business, as well as playing a role in the media that's covering renewable energy and energy changes, I've been disappointed that the major media, as they call it, that some of the info isn't that accurate, that what you're reading out there is disappointingly off and in some cases really confusing for anybody that's trying to make sense of what we need to do as a culture and as people on this planet. And some examples and this part of the reason why we're having this show. Before I introduce my guests, I just want to let you know that the real main point I want to convey today is that we're going to try and give you really accurate info to provide counterpoint to some of the confusing info that's out there. We're going to talk solar, and as an example of what you might be reading that might confuse you is, for example, in the Sacramento Bee, that a columnist Daniel Weintraub, and he had written a piece criticizing SMUD, the Sacramento utility, partnering up with a developer and doing some homes with solar. And one of his criticisms was, why engage in this type of program, in this deal, when solar panels only last 20 to 30 years? And any of you that have shopped around or own this technology know that the lifespan for current technologies is unknown, I believe. We'll find out more about that from our folks here in the studio. But then even in alternative news media like the Sacramento News and Review, months ago, they did an article on energy. And when it came to solar, they said that solar isn't even protected from shortages, as silicon is now reaching its peak. And they described silicon as having some sort of peak, while silicon is the second most abundant element in the Earth's crust. So there's a lot of confusing stuff out there. And we're going to try and sort that out with our guests today. And I want to welcome them all here. We've got Daniel Flanagan, the founder of California Solar Electric Company. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
And Daniel, real quickly, how long have you been in solar, and do you have any special degrees or license certification? And we'll make sure that folks know exactly who we're talking to and how credible you guys are.
I've been involved in solar for about a decade, ramping up to it via my involvement in the electrical trade. I'm a C10 electrical contractor. As far as other certifications, there's a national certification called NABCEP, North American Board of Certified Energy Practitioners, and I'm a certificate with that organization. And basically what I do is run a installation company, and we focus on design and installation of systems. So we're on the ground implementing these systems for people and for businesses.
And I didn't warn you guys before I invited you on the air, but I'm going to ask the question of each of you. So do you live with solar?
So, yes, I actually live in an off-grid solar home. I've been off-grid for about 12 years. So in some ways I've been involved in solar for over a decade. But, yeah, so I have an off-grid solar electric home.
Great. And Johnny Hill, we've got you here. Thanks so much. Johnny is the gentleman that's really put solar on the map here and actually got my start in the renewable energy business. And Johnny, you've been doing it so long. I think you invented the term solar, didn't you?
Yeah, something like that.
So tell us about your how long you've been doing solar and any special degrees that you have, certifications.
Well, let's see. I have a degree in mechanical engineering, and I've been doing solar since 1980. That would be 28 years. And I'm the founder and owner of Sierra Solar Systems in Grass Valley.
And do you live with solar is the question.
Absolutely. I have lived with solar since the very day I discovered it, when Sam Vanderhoff walked into my then Earth store back in 1980 and showed me a little photovoltaic module and said, at the time, I don't know those of you that remember the Earth store, but it was a kind of a general store, you know, and we sold a lot of kerosene and some rolling papers, things like that. But anyway, so he brought in this little solar panel and said, I said, what's that? He said, well, you know, this is something you should really sell because it'll charge batteries and you can run your lights. And I said, oh, that's going to really be bad for the kerosene business.
Which wasn't such a sad thing.
But many of us up on the ridge at the time were living many miles from power, and so we were all off-grid. PG&E wanted to charge me $208,000 at the time to bring power in and said, we suggest an alternative means of producing power, and so here we are.
And you were one of the first in the whole state to hook up a solar electric system to the power lines. Is that right? You and Skip Allen Smith.
I believe I was the second, and John Schaefer, the originator, founder of Real Goods, was the first.
Mm. And you were the second.
Mm-hmm.
And Skip Allen Smith.
Well, we put in a system for Skip that was completely off-grid for quite a while, and then after a while, he did. Power did come down his road, and then we did connect him up to the grid, too.
Great. Thanks so much. And I want to introduce our last guest here. Ray Darby is the president of Sustainable Energy Group, a Grass Valley company providing solar and energy efficiency services, including consultation, design, build, servicing of systems. Ray Darby, how long have you been doing solar? Tell us a little bit about yourself, certifications, degrees, and do you have solar?
Well, I, like Johnny, have been in it for a while. I actually became professionally involved with solar, working with the solar office of what's now become the California Energy Commission back in 1978. And my focus at that time, and I think fair to say since then, has been solar and efficiency. But back then there wasn't very much solar electric, as you are aware. Passive solar was very popular then, and it's making a huge comeback now. I got a degree in mechanical engineering from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. I am currently a licensed professional engineer. Our company, Sustainable Energy Group, we are licensed general contractors as well as C10 electrical and C36 plumbing contractors. And as you said, we do design build. My first foray into photovoltaics, which is how I first met Johnny, was in the early 80s, probably shortly after he started carrying solar equipment, and I lived in a little off-grid home out on the ridge that needed a new charge controller, and that was probably, I think, 81 or 82 is how I first met Johnny here. The home that I'm living in currently has solar. It's currently connected to the grid, but it is a battery backup system. So if power goes off, I can run for quite a long time without PG&E because I have several electric vehicles that in the past during extended power outages I've actually had to plug in to my system and back myself up a little bit with battery power from my EVs.
Make sure you tell them where you got your system.
I purchased my first system from Mr. Hill, installed it myself with some help from Dan Felix, formerly Felix Electric. And, yeah.
Yeah. You're a huge EV buff, too. So you've right. you've got solar hot water. You've got hydropower.
The works. Hydropower, passive solar, home. So my base heating requirements are extremely low. If we've had a sunny day, we can get all the way down to freezing at night, and my heating system doesn't need to come on.
Well, before we get started into, I want to make sure people know about what the current incentives are for the different technologies out there because things are changing. And then we'll talk about the technology on-grid versus off-grid. But I wanted to give each of you a chance, and starting with Ray, to try and dispel what are some of the main myths that you're hearing as you do business, that common myths that, for instance, the panels don't last very long or keep waiting, it's going to get cheaper and it's not competitive with utility prices, that type of thing. And Ray, you're in an interesting position where you're also doing media and journalism. You've got a weekly column for the local newspaper, The Union, and recently you actually did a couple columns about the myths concerning solar electricity. So what people might not be aware is that a lot of the media is really crafted for national message, and that things are really different here in Northern California and PG&E territory in regards to solar. Tell us, dispel a myth for folks. What are some of the common myths you hear? And then Johnny and Daniel ask the same.
Well, I don't want to steal all the thunder. Leave something for Johnny and Daniel to address. But I think one of the more common myths that I've heard, and you mentioned it yourself, is and the fact that media, which you would hope would have done some research prior to making statements like the one you mentioned regarding SMUD, would do a little bit of research and provide some accurate information. Panels do not last 20 or 30 years. As you accurately stated, we don't know how long they're going to last. We have modules that were manufactured in the 80s, some of which are putting out almost the same amount of net power, according to the National Renewable Energy Lab, as they did the day they were born or manufactured. I like to think of them as being born. I love them so much. But at any rate, if you look at tests that have been done on various types of modules, and it depends on the type of technology, but for crystalline-style modules, which is the predominant module being installed out there in the world today by all of us, they're showing at the very most less than one-half of 1% of output degradation per year. And if you graph it, as I did in one of my recent articles in The Union, the Home Seller Showcase section, you'll find that it takes about 45 years before you really get down to as low as 80% of their original output if you go with exactly one-half of 1%. The manufacturers are actually warranting their modules for 25 years to be no less than 80% of their original output, and typically they're much higher than that. So other than a few manufacturing defects that surface from time to time with this manufacturer, that manufacturer, I fully anticipate solar modules are going to last well beyond most of our lifetimes, still producing plenty of power. That's one myth. So they don't last 20 or 30 years and go away.
All right.
John, I can go on, but let's Johnny.
Yeah, let's get some myths out of
the way. I've got some 30-year-old panels on my roof that are still functioning quite well and putting out at least 80% of what they were when they were new, and they make them a whole lot better now than they did then, I can tell you that.
What are some other what's another common myth that you hear from the public that's worth dispelling on the air to all the listeners?
I would say that there's a myth that solar is a rich person's toy and that average people can't afford it. It's not cost-effective by any means, and that couldn't be further from the truth, especially now with the incentives and the tax credits that are available. It is entirely possible to put in a photovoltaic system that will provide for most or all of your needs and make payments on that system that would be on par with the amount that you're actually saving on your PG&E bill. So in essence, it's really costing you nothing.
And the idea that it is expensive, what I've noticed in the news media is that's kind of true in some parts of the country, that it still might be not cost effective. Most of the country's got really cheap utility power, relatively expensive solar power because of no state programs, and here in PG&E territory, it's quite the opposite.
Expensive Plus, we have great sun.
Right. Daniel, you want to take a crack at busting a myth for us?
Yeah, I guess the next obvious one would be that there's some fantastic technology just around the corner that people should wait for. And that's been happening for as long as I've been involved in this. And, you know, it's the cocktail party conversation. You know, once someone finds out you're in solar, then the next thing is, you know, oh, what about that new technology? But we also see it playing out in terms of trying to integrate on the ground and people's decisions to do solar or not. And one of the, I think, mechanisms for that misinformation is the way in which press releases and legitimate news sometimes are not very distinguishable. And also how journalists, as you said earlier, Martin, are, you know, how they're hungry for info on solar. Well, press release is a good source to fill a page with. It's not necessarily a good source to give a really good idea of what's actually happening in the industry. The companies that are developing new technologies are generally startups that are trying to create the perception of value in their product, and that functions to attract investment and to raise the value of their stock. And the press release is a very common method for getting a message out regarding the special nature of their technology and how imminent it is, that it's just around the corner. And so I think that gets out into the public quite a bit and causes this, what I would call a misperception, which could lead to delaying implementation of a really great technology that we have right now.
All right, well, thanks for that. I want to make sure that we've got time, if we can, for call-ins. That's going to probably be towards the end of the program. So if you are calling in and have questions, if you can hold on in about 20 minutes or so, what I want to make sure that we have time to cover are questions about current technology and what people can achieve both on and off-grid. I want to make sure we don't ignore solar hot water and passive solar. But a lot of folks are keenly interested in PV systems because it seems like a sexy thing to be doing. What's going on with government incentives? And first, I guess we hear a little bit about there's state rebates and then there's federal tax credits, both of which are changing, and listeners might not be aware of that. So, Ray, you want to take first crack?
Sure.
We'll just go down the line here. What's changing with state rebates? And then we'll go through and talk a little bit about the tax credits.
Well, the state rebate currently for existing homes, which given the dearth of new construction is probably best to focus on right now, it's currently $1.90 a watt until we've used up. There's just a couple more megawatts left. I checked yesterday. I try to check every day. Just a few more megawatts left at the $1.90 a watt rebate level, and that will then drop to $1.55. As far as the tax credit's concerned, as part of the corporate bailout package of $700 billion that everyone's, I'm sure, heard about by now, an extension of the federal tax credit for solar for both PV and hot water was extended. And the most exciting part of that, in addition to being extended for another, I believe it was 8 years, is the fact that they removed the cap for solar PV systems. So I was just looking at a relatively small to Midland size system for a customer that would have gotten a $2,000 capped rebate for a solar electric system, but instead is going to get about $7,800 back at the end of 2009 because we're going to wait to finish installing it until after the first of the year. In fact, we're not even going to, since it's wintertime, we're just going to wait till a nice sunny day in December to start getting the system installed in order to qualify them for almost $5,000 more rebate. So it's huge. On solar water heating, unfortunately, they didn't remove the cap, but then it turns out that the cap of $2,000 for solar water heating is not a whole lot less than what 30% would be anyway. So,
right. And Johnny, do you get a lot of people that think that the rebates are going to be going up over time, and folks may not be aware that rebates are going down?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of misinformation. I think the biggest one, though, getting back to the product itself, is they think that the price is coming down. That's another myth.
Yeah, right now, I guess, global resource shortages, whether it's shipping products around the world or just steel for the racking materials, solar is not immune from the price of oil spiking and everything coming up as a result. Even the trading versus the dollar versus euro, I've heard, has impacted the price of solar goods here in America.
Well, I think the main thing is just the exorbitant demand, and mostly out of the United States. I think most people don't realize that we're a small player in the world solar market, and that Germany and Spain and places like that are a lot bigger than we are.
And Daniel, when it comes to the tax credit, you're the gentleman here that still is living off grid. Do you think that this tax credit, since it does apply to off-gridders, do you think a lot more folks are going to be interested in off-grid? How many of our listeners might not even be aware that this new tax credit that starts after the first of the year will apply to off-grid systems, I believe? And so people that were looking at an off-grid system can now get 30% of their system as a tax credit. Is that still the case, and do you see a big boom potential for off-grid?
I think that there is not really widespread recognition amongst people who are would-be off-grid system owners or expanders of their existing systems that there are financial incentives available to them. They know for sure that there's no rebate. But even through this year, there still has been a $2,000 tax credit in place that can apply. For 09 forward, 30% tax credit. 30% is the post-rebate amount. So for grid-tied systems, it's after you've taken off the state rebate, whatever's remaining, you can realize a 30% tax credit on that. For off-grid, there is no rebate. So actually, the amount of the tax credit is potentially much larger, definitely much larger per the dollar invested in your system. The only... And I do see potential for that being very helpful to off-grid system owners. The caveat is that you need to have the tax liability to realize that tax credit. It comes right off the top of what you would owe in your federal income taxes, and you are allowed to take that over the course of 2 years. So if you purchase an off-grid solar system, Johnny's suggesting 5, I thought it was 2, but maybe that's the point that we just need to clarify. In any case, so if you want to take $10,000, your $10,000 tax credit, if what I'm saying is true, you'd need to have $5,000 in tax liability per year. Maybe we can clarify that after I'm done with this point. The other point would be that for existing system off-grid system owners, you can expand your system. That's a legitimate expense that's would qualify for the tax credit. So, yeah, on the one hand, this could potentially enable more people. Well, in a lot of cases, off-grid solar is not by choice but by necessity. So the way I see it playing out is that with this tax credit provided, a customer can realize the tax credit. We could potentially have better performing systems because the limiting factor in a lot of off-grid systems is the size of the solar array, which results in the engine generator running a lot in the winter, which is something that we want to minimize with a good design. A good design means a lot of solar panels. A lot of solar panels means more money. So my hope is that by realizing the value of the tax credit, we can design better systems and put in larger solar arrays for off-grid homes.
And so the off-gridders get the tax credit, but off-gridders don't get the rebate. And is that correct? And why don't they?
Well, I think it probably leads back to whatever the intention of the rebate program was originally and continues to be. And I think there's an emphasis on offsetting current grid usage, and for various reasons, obviously, just to produce net renewable energy is a great thing. But we also have an infrastructural problem with with the grid, and so this takes pressure off in the summer where we might have brownouts and blackouts. I don't know for sure, but I just have a hunch that whoever conceived of that distinction was just targeting the grid market for reasons such as that. Mm-hmm. And also, off-grid systems are, to be fair, hybrid renewable / fossil fuel systems typically, because they do take engine generator supplementation in the winter almost always.
So you can't get rid of a generator off-grid completely?
You could with some very, very careful design that would be thorough building and mechanical systems design, including passive solar, very high efficiency lighting, all the best technologies that could get your energy consumption very, very low, a substantial battery bank, and a substantial array to catch up after a week of no sun. But I've never seen a home like that.
All right. Well, I want to make time for some call-ins. Before we do, recently there was the major annual North American Solar Conference down in San Diego, and Johnny and I believe Daniel, you both were able to attend. And for the listeners that aren't able to attend, anything interesting, any new vibes or things? I know last year I was an attendant, and there was a lot of talk about how China, big presence from Chinese manufacturers for solar hot water and PV, and the mood must have been different this year because the conference was shortly after this big tax credit extension. And what's happening in the midst of this financial economy and this tax credit, and any new technologies or things that you see happening down there? Johnny, you want to talk a little bit about your experience, and then give it a couple minutes or so each of you, and then we're going to try and open up the phone lines.
Well, you know, I think it's just a continuation of what you saw last year. There's certainly a lot more Chinese companies. China is a world player in the world economy now, unlike a few years ago. And so, of course, they need power, and they would like to export a lot of PV as well. But the electronics, I think, is really the biggest change that we've seen over the last 10 years, even, because the type of modules that we're selling right now are very similar to what we sold 10, 20 years ago, to be perfectly honest. But the technology in the electronics is amazingly different, and there's new stuff all the time. There's new inverter manufacturers, controller manufacturers, and the old manufacturers coming out with new stuff all the time. They've got to stay ahead of the technology curve, or they're just not going to be in business anymore. There's one very interesting new device that you're probably familiar with. It's called the Enphase inverter, which rather than having an inverter, I don't know how, maybe we should explain what an inverter is, but it's the piece of electronics that takes the DC power from the solar array, turns it into AC 240 volt, and feeds it back into the power grid. Well, up till now, we've had to use one inverter for an entire solar array, and that wasn't necessarily convenient or efficient because sometimes part of the solar array would be shaded, and because of the way the modules are hooked up in a series connect per solar module. So if you've got one solar module shaded, rather than losing maybe a third or a half of your entire system, you've lost one little piece. So if we had 30 modules, we're only losing 1/30th. Fantastic advance, and I think it'll really help some people that have, you know, partial intermittent shading on their array.
And that was the product that I heard most about, was the Enphase, the concept of a small inverter behind every single solar panel when it came to what the biggest deal was. Yeah, Ray, you look like you want to chime in.
In fact, one more thing. Uh-huh. Isn't Ken Shelton, isn't he still associated with KVMR to a certain extent? I know he volunteers engineering services from time to time.
I'm not
well,
sure.
He's one of the primary people in the Enphase company.
Local ties, a lot of local ties to the solar industry out of Nevada County for sure. Ray, you were itching to say something.
I was just going to ask Johnny or maybe Dan if you could address the Enphase in terms of the cost comparison between that and a central inverter.
It's a little bit more, but not terribly, really. Maybe another 30% more, but on the other hand, because you can get more power out of your array and because you're just wiring up AC once you're wiring all the end phases together, installation costs may come down. So I don't think it's necessarily that much more money.
Daniel, what about your experiences? Are you want to touch on the end phase as well? And what did you see down there at the big conference in San Diego?
Well, the thing that stands out most is just the scale of it. I mean, it's getting bigger and bigger every year. You partly go down there and just get sort of the pulse of the industry, and it was pretty intense. There was a lot more booth dedicated to manufacturing technologies, which is, you know, on a whole other level than we're dealing with here. There's more financial institutions, legal firms, so it's just a bigger business type feel for sure. As far as the technologies, for sure, the Enphase inverters that's the most significant new product, I'd say. And I would say that it, from a techie point of view, it's very cool. But from the bottom line of just trying to produce power, it's not like everything else is obsolete and this is the new thing by any means. It would take too much time to go into the details. But data monitoring, some benefits in terms of shading if you have a shady site, mixed up roof surfaces and so on, it can remedy issues. But it's not necessarily revolutionary. Other little things I saw on the technology side, I saw a DC generator. This is all sort of off-grid stuff. For anyone who's got an old DR, modified sine wave inverter, there's a cool pure sine wave swap out where they made the chassis the same exact size. So just little things like that I like to walk around and check out. The other thing that was interesting is connecting with the folks that are going to be that are part of the two companies that are becoming established in Grass Valley as we speak, which is Grow Solar, setting up over in Grass Valley as a distributor, and Keiko taking over the old SMA America building up Loma Rica, inverter manufacturer. So there's sort of a community of solar professionals that we're able to socialize and chat, and it's kind of exciting how much activity there is locally.
Not to leave out Open Energy also up at Whispering Pines.
And there's Open Energy too.
And now Sierra College actually is working with local businesses to get a curriculum going. And before I forget, let me mention there's one more day for anyone that wants to apply to be the photovoltaic program developer. For Sierra College, interested individuals should send a letter and resume by tomorrow. And if you want more info about that, you can email me at energyreport@kvmr.org. This is, a solar consultant that is essentially going to work with Sierra College to oversee implementing a brand new curriculum for PV designers and installers that will start next year. So you guys ready to take some calls? The phones are lighting up. You're willing to take some calls?
Why not?
Absolutely.
Hi, caller. You're live on KVMR. Make sure that you have your radio turned down in the background. Did you have a question for any of our solar experts here?
Yes, I do.
All right, throw it at us.
Well, I'm just wondering what the future looks like for utilizing solar for transportation. I know that Ray has worked on an electric car for many years, and, Johnny, of course, probably would know something about if there's going to be a future that we can rely on a sustainable clean energy for transportation and public transportation, etc.
Great. Thanks for that question. I'm going to let Ray answer that one first because it seems well-suited. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. See you guys.
All righty. Ray?
Yeah, thanks for a really excellent question because I think the answer helps address one of the concerns that a lot of people voice about solar and as well as wind being an intermittently available resource. And what do we power up all the homes and businesses in California with when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing? And it turns out that there are technologies available, actually being tested, naturally not widespread yet, but could very easily be widespread in the future, that would allow you to get some credits by using your electric vehicle parked in your driveway, plugged into your PG&E utility grid, to help feed some energy back into the grid when your solar isn't producing and without adversely impacting the need for your vehicle to be fully charged for you to do what you need to do. I can say that I've been driving purely electric for a little over 10 years now, and it's a lot more practical than a lot of people think. People will often ask me, well, but you've got a 40-mile limitation on the range of your electric vehicle. What do you do when you travel out of town? And my answer to that is, well, I try not to travel out of town because it's inherently non-sustainable, and I try to be more sustainable. And transportation is, in essence, one of the most non-sustainable things that we do. So If I do go out of town, it's very rarely. I understand statistically the average person takes maybe 3 or 4 trips a year that would be beyond the range of an electric vehicle. My experience has been that it's extremely practical. My entire electricity bill last year was $49.02 for my home and half of my family's transportation. This year, I think it's going to be very close to zero. Should be getting my bill any day. And I think as batteries become more widespread and economies of scale are achieved with some of the new battery technologies, which is really exciting stuff, that we're going to see electric drive being an entirely practical opportunity for most people.
So there isn't enough surface area on a vehicle right now to practically power it with a car that has solar built into it. So do you have an idea about what type of solar system, depending on people's habits? And because there are folks that are now getting interested saying, I'd like to get a plug-in hybrid or an electric and solar power it. So there hasn't been a lot of talk about this connection of what are you talking about? And I don't think a lot of folks have an idea when it comes to powering a vehicle with solar. Are we talking a $100,000 solar system or something more modest?
No. I've got about 3,600 watts, which I think all of us could agree is small to middling, probably. And I just have a very efficient home. Electric drive is inherently very efficient. And I try to drive between 8 and 12,000 miles a year at the most. And much of that is back and forth to work and work-related mileage, as opposed to other mileage. I plan trips so that I don't waste a lot of time and miles. And so is it feasible? Yes. I think as far as the solar electric side of it goes, as Johnny pointed out, in most cases, it's cheaper to pay the bank every month than it used to be to pay PG&E. As far as the electric vehicles are concerned, we're not quite there yet, with the exception of the neighborhood electric vehicles. Several people in town here have the little Zen, which is my personal favorite. And if you don't need to go more than 25 miles an hour and you can and take surface streets, it's entirely practical here and now. And I think within the next few years, we'll see electric drive with solar being even more practical.
Well, should we take another call? Anyone want to add anything to that? All right, let's try another caller. Hi, caller, you're live on KVMR. You have a question for our solar experts, and please make sure your radio is turned down in the background.
Yes. I realize a lot of your analysis is in terms of dollar cost and value. I'm wondering if anyone knows of measurements done in actual BTU, energy in, energy out. I've had trouble finding that sort of stuff on the internet because this is such a high-tech, high-value item. You know, even all the cells in the inverters, all that stuff. Even the fact that it's sitting on this aluminum frame, which is takes a lot of BTUs to produce that aluminum. Has anyone actually done analysis in terms of energy in, energy out over the lifetime? Because as the dollar crashes, we're going to start looking at things differently in terms of actual cost.
Great, thanks. So you're referring to PV panels, to solar electric?
To PV panels.
Sure, okay.
Right.
Thanks. Let's let Johnny answer that question. Thanks for calling in.
Great.
Well, first of all, to be perfectly clear, we in the PV world don't really talk about BTUs. We talk about kilowatts and kilowatt hours because that's a measure of electricity, though it can be converted. But there is another myth that it actually, and I've heard this many times, that it actually takes more energy to produce a photovoltaic module than that module will produce over its lifetime, and that couldn't be further from the truth. It may take enough energy, you're going to be even within the first year for sure. I think a lot quicker than that even. So, but as far as the BTUs go, I'd talk about BTUs when we're talking about solar hot water and maybe space heating. But as far as PV goes, I'd talk about kilowatts.
Ray or Daniel, want to anything to energy payback or trying to frame it in some sort of BTU comparison or?
I don't know about. I've never seen anything in terms of BTU. I've just seen things written in terms of. energy payback, essentially. I thought that for some manufacturer, I don't know if it's manufacturers or it's third party, but I had a number in my mind that Evergreen was claiming an 18-month energy payback, something like that. So obviously that depends on where they're being shipped. And as we have factories at different countries around the world, it'll dramatically change if you have to put a solar module on a ship that's burning dirty diesel coming across the ocean, and many modules do. But even taking the worst case scenario of a module that maybe is being manufactured in a facility that's not particularly energy efficient and getting put on a freighter and coming across the ocean, you're still going to produce way more power per module over the course of its lifetime than it took to go into getting it to that location.
Certainly better than a power plant, nuclear power plant. Ray Darby.
Yeah, I just recently was reading, it was one of the national labs, they were saying it was about a four-year payback, energy payback, for most types of cell technologies. Evergreen's website, I believe, says that it's about 1 year. Their module manufacturing process uses quite a bit less silicon and less energy, and they market them as having half the carbon footprint, which is, I know, why a lot of us here in this room like Evergreen modules, aside from the fact they're made here right in the USA.
So 1 to 4 years, depending on technology, yeah, is
but about
energy,
one for the
energy
Evergreen
payback. Okay, ready for another one?
Sure.
Hi, you're live on KVMR's The Energy Report. You have a question or a dial tone? Hi, you're live on KVMR with The Energy Report. We have solar experts today. Do you have a question for them?
I do. I was wondering if I could hear their opinions on what the role of solar power, both passive and PV panels, is for non-homeowners. Also, if they could mention any knowing of any projects that have to do with apartment buildings or something like this, not only new apartments, but maybe upgrades to existing and or solar, just kind of like tools or something that would be non-attached to the building that might be beneficial to non-homeowners.
Excellent question. Thanks so much for asking. Who wants to try and take a crack at that one? How have you guys played a role in as far as tenants and landlords and solar powering those types of situations, Johnny?
Well, I can say that that my company is in a building that we don't own, and yet we have a 13-kilowatt solar electric system on the roof that powers our offices.
That's true of our shop as well.
So you need a cooperative landlord, yeah. Basically.
You have to get permission from the landlord
if
a tenant's going to be buying it. Well, have you done situations where the landlords bought the system? And
absolutely.
Ray, what do you got for us? I see you look like you got something to tell us.
Yeah, I had too much coffee this morning, so I'm jumping up and down more than my two compatriots here. No, actually, we just did a system installation for a landlord. Customer that we've done another system for in the past on his own home, and his approach, and I think a lot of landlords should take note, is if I put solar on my rental, then when I go to rent it, I can rent it to someone with the idea that they will not have a PG&E bill. That makes my rental more competitive than the many other rentals available, and I think over time, I don't think we're quite there yet, but I anticipate we will be. Could be a matter of months, could be a matter of years, before it's going to be really important to a renter when he goes to rent that the utility bills are going to be affordable, because utility bills can easily exceed rent in many cases. And so landlords out there, think about that.
So a recent example would be the Union Street building down here in Nevada City. Tintel did the construction. I think it's co-owned by Tintel and Robinson, and we put solar there. The building owners actually own the solar system, and it is in one way or another prorated into the rent. But I think if I understood the caller's question, I think he was sounded more of a personal question, like he might have personal interest. And I think With regard to the question of it, say, not attached to the building, the rebate program is very explicit about it being an integrated portion of the building. So in terms of portable systems that could qualify for rebates, that would be problematic. I think that your best bet is to, you know, work with whoever the building owner is to try and convince them that it's a good thing and be an agent of that process.
So a tenant that's interested in trying to see if they can convince their landlord to go solar could contact your companies, and you guys would be able to run the numbers and see if the tenant can make a convincing argument is basically what tenants can do if they can't afford it themselves. Okay, let's give a crack at one more phone call, and then we'll give you guys some last comments and make sure you give out your contact info. Hi, caller. You're live on KVMR's Energy Report. Please make sure your radio is turned down in the background. You got a question for our solar experts? That is, yep, you are the one.
All right, good. Yes, I have a couple. Number one, can you give me a reference, or maybe you know yourself, how solar compares to nuclear? That's the first thing, because we've been talking more about nuclear energy with Bush administration, and I think it's a mistake. I think if we invested that money in solar, we'd be far, far ahead, but maybe you guys have some numbers on that, and... Secondly, as long as communities are going to invest in things like nuclear power, wouldn't they be better off by investing in large area solar arrays here in Northern California with our trees and everything, rather than, say, a nuclear power plant? And I'll just listen on the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. All right, who wants to take a stab at that, Ray?
Oh, boy.
Johnny?
Thanks.
Daniel, everybody?
Well, first, I've got to say that there is no such thing radioactive solar waste, and we really don't have to find a place in the desert a couple of miles deep to bury the old solar panels. So I think that's big.
And we only have a minute or two, so give it a quick response, and then I want to give you guys a chance to give out your contact info and some wrap up comments. But anything about the idea of large community solar farms?
Yeah.
I know there's a big push for that to try and do that as a community here.
It makes a whole lot of sense on buildings, because then the electrons have the shortest possible path and therefore lose the least on the way. Central power generation, we've got to get away from it. It's not sustainable. It's inherently non-sustainable. About two-thirds of the energy that goes in at the distant power plant comes out over on our end, whether it's nuclear, natural gas, which is predominant in our service territory. Central generation doesn't make sense. And when you look at nuclear or any other technology for that matter, and you look at the big picture, which includes expansion of the transmission and distribution infrastructure needed to get that new power plant's power to the people, versus distributed generation, solar on rooftops or next best thing on a community scale, there's no comparison. And I'll just leave it at that. Let Daniel get a word in if he has.
Yeah, Daniel, go ahead and give us some final comments. We're about to run out of time, so make sure you give out this is Daniel Flanagan from California Solar Electric Company, phone number, website, and some wrap-up comments for our listeners.
That was a dovetail on Ray's comment that the distributed energy is what we call power that's produced on-site, and that's a real important distinction for the reasons Ray was pointing out. We like renewable energy, but we like distributed renewable energy, on-site power production, even better. The only other comment I would make is if you have interest in solar, don't let one of those myths that we talked about earlier scare you away. Solar is completely scalable, and you've got good solar companies here in the area that can do free analysis for you. Check it out. There's lots of options. Again, my company's California Solar Electric Company. We're located in Grass Valley. Our phone number is 274-3671, and our website's www.cal-solar.com.
Thanks, Daniel, for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Johnny Hill, give us contact info. How can people get a hold of you and see our solar systems? Any final comments?
Well, I'll just give you my contacts because I know we're running out of time. And certainly, if you have any questions, feel free to call us. We're at the Alternative Building Center in Grass Valley at 563 Idaho Maryland Road. And our phone number is locally 530-273-6754 or toll-free 888-ON-SOLAR. And our website is www.sierrasolar.com.
Thanks for coming in, Johnny. And Ray Darby, how can folks get a hold of you and Sustainable Energy Group?
Our phone number is 273-4422. We're on the web at www.sustainableenergygroup.com.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Thanks for the callers. Thanks to Ray, Johnny, and Daniel for coming in today. And tune in the first Thursday of next month. We'll be back with more energy reports for you.